Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be talking about tax credits and House of Lords reform. As many listeners will know, this week has been something of a controversial one for the House of Lords, with the second chamber putting a halt to the government's plans to cut tax credits. Opponents of the plans are, of course, delighted that the changes have been put, at the very least delayed, whilst the Conservatives are incandescent with rage, claiming a constitutional crisis and vowing to look again at the implications of this recent events for Lords reform. So where are we now? Will the plans' tax credit changes go ahead eventually? What next for the House of Lords? And how damaged is George Osborne by the whole affair in his supposed plan to become the next Prime Minister of the UK? I'm joined today by Rob Vance and James Stewart to discuss these issues and others in more detail. Welcome, chaps. So let's start at the beginning. I mean, it's probably worth recapping what's actually taken place this week and I guess why it's so controversial for those that maybe are less familiar. James, you've been looking at this.
Yeah, so I'm going to take you back to a budget, but not the most recent budget. In fact, the 1909 People's Budget, which Lloyd George introduced, which has sort of set the framework for where we are today with the House of Lords and how it works with the House of Commons. That budget proposed a major cut, a major increase in tax on big estates. And understandably, the people who owned the big estates, who were hereditary peers in the House of Lords, didn't take kindly to it. And so there was a big argument between the two different chambers about what should happen. And the argument sustained for 2 years. There were two elections, one new monarch and a threat to pack the House of Lords with hundreds of Lib Dem, or Liberal peers, as it was then. And in the end, that resulted with the Parliament Act. And the Parliament Act basically gives primacy in legislation to the House of Commons, and it also says that the House of Lords cannot amend any finance bill. So that means that if a bill is put through the House of Commons as a finance bill, the House of Lords has no say on it. That's where it gets slightly complicated, given what happened. But there's also a convention which was introduced after the Second World War called the Salisbury Convention. Now, this says that any party who has stood on a manifesto and got elected and is delivering that manifesto, the House of Lords can't amend any of the manifesto commitments.
So, Rob, how does that relate to this week, then? What's your take?
Well, those two principles are where it relates to this week, because the first thing is, does this count as a finance bill? So the Conservative, because it includes numbers, the Conservatives have talked about it as if it was a finance bill, which it isn't. Because what it is, I mean, this is slightly contested, but effectively it's an amendment to a previous Act of Parliament, which was done as a welfare and pensions, a DWP bill, I think back in the early 2000s under, you know, Gordon Brown as Chancellor. So it's an amendment to that. And furthermore, it's not just an amendment to it, it's a statutory instrument, which means that you have primary legislation, which says that something's going to happen, and then you have secondary legislation or statutory instruments, which is effectively say how it's going to happen. It instructs a department on how to do things. And they are somewhat easier to update and amend. They require fewer readings. And in the Commons, they tend not to be amended, whereas the Lords on this occasion have amended it, which is part of the issue. And then the second way in which the things that James so eloquently described apply to this are whether or not tax credits and the reform of them was included in the Conservative manifesto. And ironically enough, the Conservatives at the election refused to be drawn on whether the manifesto commitment to cut £12 billion from welfare applied to tax credits, despite the Labour Party quite vociferously saying that is the only way in which you're going to get £12 billion out of welfare. And now we've sort of come full circle with the Conservatives saying, well, actually, we said that we're going to reduce the deficit, and the way in which we are saying that we're going to do this, therefore it is covered under a manifesto commitment, and therefore the Salisbury Convention applies.
So the Tory perspective, essentially, you're breaking this convention, it's completely out of order, regardless of what you think of the policy.
Two of them, really.
Two of them. Regardless of what you think of the policy, that's not really what's important.
But it's very vague on both of them. I mean, both of them are conventions, and so there's no real clarity, and basically it's up for debate. And the Tories are choosing to make the argument that this is the House of Lords exceeding its scope. And
it's even if they concede the specifics, there's a kind of a principle at stake here, which is this is effectively an economic measure being passed by a Chancellor, therefore it should not be subject to this kind of amendment. Though, of course, ironically enough, it could have been made, I believe it would have been possible for this to have been made into a finance bill if they had so chosen to do so. Like, there's a formal process in which you do that. You say, this is a finance bill, and the Speaker would say, this is indeed a finance bill, and And you know, but they, my understanding is that in effect Osborne chose not to do that because he wanted to get it through the Commons without being amended.
And so James, presumably, yeah, this is annoyed the Chancellor somewhat, and he thinks that he's been hard done by.
Well,
maybe he's got his parliamentary tactics wrong.
Well, I think arguably he has got his parliamentary tactics wrong, but I think it might be an example of him being a bit too clever by half, because the reason he made it a statutory instrument was to stop there being a big debate in the Commons about it, where it could have been amended. But what he's done is move that debate to the Lords, where the Lords have decided that the Parliament Act doesn't apply and the Salisbury Convention doesn't apply, and they've decided to send the statutory instrument back to the House of Commons for amends.
So let's move on to the actual sort of cause of all this furore and sort of reforms to tax credits. I suppose, as with welfare, it's often quite a divisive issue if we look at the opinion polls, and this obviously, as I say, is a polling podcast, because often the public think that there's too much spent on welfare, just generically speaking. But then, you know, they do have a sense of, you know, what is fair and what isn't, and the concept that, you know, poor people shouldn't be unjustly penalised. So, I mean, Rob, you've been looking at some of the polling on this. I think YouGov put some numbers out recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the sort of vibe we're getting from public opinion on this issue?
So, as you rightly point out, it's a complicated one. I think the first thing that's interesting, of course, is that lots of people, and the YouGov poll's quite clear on this, many people aren't actually following this particularly closely. You know, we're talking about an issue that 15% say very closely, you know, fewer than half are even fairly closely or very closely following it. So there's not a huge amount of engagement with something which is a complicated issue. You're right, generally speaking, when you ask people, you know, in a sort of closed question, do you want to reduce welfare spending, they say yes. Though, of course, the tax credits issue is more complicated than that. It is a classic example of a kind of third way-ish, you know, it's Clinton that invented the sort of negative income tax, and then Brown adopted it under, you know, mainly in the second term of the Labour government, and it's specifically about in-work benefits. It was a design, this is not about, you know, unemployment spending or disability spending, of which there are lots and lots of complicated arguments, but arguably the British people as a whole are, in a sense, more against spending there. Whereas this is in-work benefits, which affect a huge number of people. It's one of the reasons why they're so expensive, because effectively it's a way of topping up, actually up to, you know, some reasonably middle-income households, what their, you know, in effect, their take-home post-tax pay is. The interesting thing about the fairness piece, and I think we've observed this on the podcast before, is fairness is very much in the eye of the beholder. It's not so much a sort of a neutral viewpoint on what, you know, what is or isn't fair in a kind of philosophical sense. It's very much about how these affect me. And you can see this most clearly in the fact that in terms of whether they're fair or unfair, overall, 28% of people are saying that they're fair, 46% unfair. But those numbers are much, much closer together amongst those who are 60 plus, who, of course, are not going to be affected by this and who have been the primary beneficiaries of, you know, triple lock on pensions and having their welfare spending protected. So I think it's a good example, once again, of, you know, how fairness really is about, you know, what it means for me rather than what it means in a sort of, you know, more sort of theoretical sense.
I want to come to James. One of the things that I observed in that poll, which I thought was quite interesting, was that one in five Conservative voters thought that these changes were unfair, which shows that, you know, this is something that definitely sort of crosses party lines as at least a controversial issue. And although the sample size is relatively small, I think around 100-ish, about half of UKIP voters thought it was unfair as well. So, well, I mean, it's something that's crossing everything. But, James, I mean,
well, they're going to be affected, right?
Absolutely.
20%, at least 20% of people who voted Conservatives in 2015 are going to see that real incomes, at least in the short term, cut.
Yeah, I think when you talk about the reality of the tax credits issue, if the government are seeking to save £4 billion from tax credits, that means that 4 million people will be losing £1,000 each. Now, that is just a colossal number in terms, a colossal impact on their income, and is bound to have penetration eventually through to what people think and how they plan to vote and what their perceptions of the Tories' leadership is. I think it's one of those issues where, like the poll tax was, where people will actually feel a political policy directly in their pocket.
Do you think, James, this, I mean, like, you were involved heavily at the sort of, I guess, upper echelons, for want of a better phrase, of Labour in the last Parliament. Welfare's obviously always been a bit of a challenge for Labour, hasn't it, in terms of, and as has this concept of making tough decisions to balance the books. I mean, how do you think Labour responds to this? Or do you think this is such a toxic issue for the Tories that it's almost an open goal?
Well, I think that the Tories themselves will actually row back from this, so will either phase the policy in or stop new people being eligible for tax credits, which would in the medium term save significant amounts of money. But I mean, I think the debate around welfare is slightly warped, because if you ask people what they think of welfare, they'll say it's too high. If you look at what's actually included in the welfare bill, there's some things that people would not countenance cutting. So everything from like benefits paid to severely disabled people, that's included. Pensions are included in the broader welfare bill, and also tax credits, which apply to huge numbers of working families, people who would normally be characterised as sort of doing the right thing.
Maternity pay, you know, or indeed, you know, the kind of, you know, benefits which, a lot of which are paid up for out of national insurance. I mean, that's what
I feel like pensions are largely sort of a no-go area, just because of the propensity of older people.
But that's a political choice. I mean, and that's why I pulled out the 60-plus cross-tab in the YouGov sample, because the
reality is... Smart politics, though, maybe?
Well, certainly in terms of, you know, who voted at the last election. And I think one of the interesting things will be the extent to which it's discussed about whether this was a manifesto commitment or not, because, you know, I suspect that there are people who will be affected by this, and this is one of the reasons for doing it early in the Parliament rather than later in the Parliament, and possibly an argument for, in a sense, getting the shock of a fall in real income done now rather than later, which is that, in a sense, pensioners knew that they weren't going to be affected. They believed the triple lock guarantee, and you know, as we know, people of pension age disproportionately voted Conservative in the 2015 election, up from 2010. A key sort of, you know, it's been a key demographic for them and continues to be. I suspect that there may have been at least a handful of seats of people which, you know, you could imagine flipping if it had been explicit that this, you know, as James points out, whether it's 2 million, whether it's 4 million, you know, that they would have, you know, been about to lose out a significant amount of money. You know, I think that is an electoral issue, definitely.
Let's move on to the House of Lords. We can come back to Labour a bit later and the party leaders and what it means for the future. Obviously, the Tories have maybe it's just in angst at what's happened, but they've floated this idea of... you know, potential laws reform maybe in the future, or potential changes maybe to the Parliament Act. And there's this, I don't know if it's inquiry is the right word, but there's this kind of investigation that's going to go on with Lord Strathclyde about that. I mean, the House of Lords is an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's one of these things that everyone sort of agrees that something should be done about it, but no one could quite agree what should be done
except
about
it. Except the last Tory manifesto, which said that it wasn't a priority. Which within a few months, the position has significantly changed on that. What I would say about the inquiry is that I think it was set up in haste to slightly patch over what was a very difficult political position for the government to be in. And so I would imagine that the inquiry has been set up, and it will maybe suggest some slight tweaks to how the House of Lords deals with statutory instruments. But I don't for a second envisage it going down the route of wholesale reform of the House of Lords. I think that is something that too many prime ministers have been burnt with before for David Cameron to take on.
I mean, Rob, what's your sense of what public opinion says about the House of Lords? I mean, presumably, I mean, the public aren't generally that engaged in constitutional matters. So, I mean, do you think that there's a sense of... My impression is there's a sense that change needs to happen. Probably being a bit elected sounds quite good, because that's democratic, but no real drive.
Public opinion is typically contradictory in this. I mean, I think people don't like elected politicians a lot, and their trust in them has gone down over time. So people want contradictory things. You say, do you want a more democratic House of Lords? They say yes, because in a sense, lots of people still have in mind the House of Lords, and let's bear in mind it is still true to a large extent, you know, titans of industry, wealthy landowners, whatever else it is, or celebrities and so on. Whereas people also want expertise in the House of Lords. And so, you know, without wanting to go into a whole big sort of lecture on, you know, what the role of a revising chamber is and so on, like, people want more experts, fewer elected politicians, but also more elections. So there's a sort of, you know, deeply contradictory sort of set of public attitudes towards the House of Lords. And let's face it, it's ultimately played out to a large extent in the, you know, the political priorities of both the Conservatives and the Labour Party, and indeed the Liberal Democrats, who have called for a long time for House of Lords reform, but have gone relatively quiet on that now, given that it's the one chamber where they've got something close to their, you know, a reflection of their, as it were, popular vote. Labour, you know, at times Jack Straw did a bunch of stuff to try and get Lords reform through, but, you know, we saw a classic situation where, I can't remember the exact details, but, you know, the Commons voted for two contradictory motions, I believe, where, you know, there was a motion for 100% elected or 0% elected, you know, in a sense, both a fully elected and a fully appointed chamber both won a majority. And the reality is, at the moment, Labour are calling, you know, are very, you know, aren't calling for the House of Lords reform, and the Conservatives are. Those positions were reversed 10, 12 years ago when the original hereditary peers thing went through. And the key thing for the Strathclyde Commission is that ultimately the House of Lords has to, in a sense, vote it, you know, sign its own death warrant. So there's no way of getting any reform of the House of Lords done without the consent of the House of Lords, which is why we ended up with the 92 elected hereditary peers, because that was the way of getting through the previous set of Lords reform. This time round, you would have to have a similar set of things. The reason why the original Parliament Act was signed was because the gun to the head of the, creating 500 extra, you know, Liberal peers.
One thing that the government have been briefing this week, I suspect, as I said, is not actually a real threat, but they've suggested they might pack the Lords with 100 extra Tory peers.
It's not going to happen.
But it might not happen. But what do the numbers say? What can you anticipate from the numbers on the House of on opinions associated with the House of Lords about what the public's view of that would be?
I would imagine that it would be very, very negative. I mean, I don't have any numbers on it. I have not seen anybody come out with any polling.
I think it would be viewed extremely cynically, but yeah. I'm not sure it's going to be as emotive or as important as the tax credits issue, because ultimately government does something slightly cynical. That's bad. Do you think this gives you a better or worse impression of the government? Yeah. Oh, it's worse. Is it going to move?
I think it would be the kind of thing. I mean,
probably not.
I mean, my view is that I think going back to the original, I think the important thing is the original issue and the original reason for it. So I think it's one of those situations where if the House of Lords was continually defeating something which was hugely, hugely popular, or was, you know, as it was historically, I mean, the People's Budget thing was, you know, repeatedly demonstrated that the House of Lords were extraordinarily selfishly, you know, blocking something which had a clear, clear popular mandate, not once, but twice. You know, King George V was hardly a radical, closet sort of radical reformer, but even he was like, you know, there is no way that you can justify not doing this, therefore, you know, you've got to sort yourselves out. And I just think on this particular issue, there's just no way that the public would wear it. If anything, what it would do would be propel an argument, which I think the Conservatives are pretty unlikely to pursue further, which is actually that would then mean that Lords reform suddenly became an actual genuine election issue, a rallying cry of this is outrageous, how can we, you know, have this situation?
Let's explore it in a little bit more detail. I mean, James mentioned earlier that he doesn't see any sort of substantial reform coming from the inquiry, and I suppose that's sensible interpretation of what's going on. I mean, presumably the problem with the House of Lords is that it's all very well it being democratic in one way or another, but once it has that, it becomes legitimate.
That's exactly the problem.
And then you end up with gridlock.
Exactly the problem that I think most members of the House of Commons want to avoid, because Britain has been described as an elective dictatorship, because if you control the Commons, which if you've got a majority of MPs, you do, then you can get pretty much anything through, with the occasional hiccup like we saw in the House of Lords. But if you give the House of Lords legitimacy, then it creates a massive management gridlock problem that the government would have to face on a daily basis.
And let's say, you know, an idea that's been suggested in the past is that the House of Lords somehow takes a sort of it becomes a PR version of the Commons in terms of, like, you know, let's say the last election. UKIP got, what was it in the end? God, I'm blanking, but 13-14% of the popular vote. So they would have 13-14% of the peers. You know, some would even consider in that scenario the House of Lords to be more legitimate than the House of Commons because it's proportional. And who then leads a government? You know, where does the Prime Minister come from? There's lots of issues there, isn't there?
These are all questions that I think MPs have absolutely no desire to see answered.
It's Pandora's box. I mean, there's just no, you know, it's, as soon as you start tinkering with it, it sort of all falls apart. And because you need effectively cross-party and cross-house consensus, that's why the thing has stalled. I mean, that's why there's been very little significant reform of it. It sort of happens at 50-year intervals. So the People's Budget, then under the Attlee government, and then again under the Labour government.
But is that a bad thing? Because, I mean, ultimately, you know, as you both know, my wife's American, and, you know, you look at the American system and you quite regularly get these situations where the government might shut down because they can't get a budget. Well, they can't get something through.
Well, that,
and we don't want that here, do we?
That's certainly not ideal. My view would be, personally, you just scrap the second chamber and you have one chamber and you increase the scrutiny within the House of Commons.
True Benite.
But
he's lurching to the left. You see the way the wind's blowing.
I mean, but that was the Labour manifesto in 1983. for sure, was, you know, the left of the Labour Party were sort of avowed unicameralists, precisely for that reason, because, you know, it's sort of the only sensible answer. But I think, I mean, I think I think my view is, if you're going to go anywhere down a sort of reform route, the place to look is somewhere like Ireland, which has a kind of a different electorate. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it has a sort of, people have a democratic mandate. There's a different kind of selectorate. It's kind of voted by the already elected. So in effect, mayors, councillors, all this kind of thing, vote for people who are drawn up from lists of quote unquote experts. So it means that you have representatives from industry and agriculture and other, as it were, sort of schools of, or sort of electoral colleges, if you like. It's sort of one way to go, but it has a very, very different mandate. It's genuinely a revising chamber that tinkers with legislation rather than radically changes it. I think, you know, going down a US route where you have totally different mandates but significant ones, as we've seen, you know, can genuinely lead to gridlock.
And if we move on to what this means, I mean, some elements of the commentariat, shall we say, I guess, of which you know, there are many, have suggested that George Osborne's had a very bad week, and that, you know, his chances of prime minister might be diminished, of becoming prime minister might become have been diminished, and that potentially the current mayor of London, Boris Johnson's, may have improved. I mean, is that overanalyzing this week's events, do we think, or do you think there's something in that in terms of the sort of big, bad, nasty chancellor, not especially popular with the public already, might find it harder to convince MPs that he's the guy?
I think in the long run, George Osborne might turn back and see this as a very good week for his long-term political career. I think that although he, in TV interviews, has looked very grumpy and hacked off by the whole thing, I think this week has stopped him delivering a policy that would have meant literally millions of people having money taken off their payslips every month. And just like Boris has his bikes, you could have had George would have had his own tax. And you don't want to become Tory leader with that kind of baggage around your neck, with so much of the electorate. And I think that he'll find a way of mollifying the policy to make cuts, but not in as direct a way, which was as kind of identifiably his policy. And I think that will actually mean that he's able to continue his journey to be Tory leader.
Go to Rob. I mean, what do you think? Because it seems to me that maybe the issue that Osborne might face is not so much whether this policy goes through or not, but maybe that the hint of nastiness, that sort of nasty party edge, is something that may be seen around him. Whereas if you're a Boris Johnson or somebody else trying to take him on, then maybe you can find some clear water to, maybe not to the left of him in the traditional sense, but to be a sort of friendlier One Nation version that can sort of come in and convince Tory MPs you're the guy and win the election in future.
Maybe, but then I think it's a strange positioning to end up with, in that I think it's unlikely that Boris Johnson can win the Tory leadership as being a sort of cuddly, softer alternative. I think, you know, if you think about what Boris Johnson's negatives are, both within the Conservative Party, but also the nation at large, it's, you know, does he make tough decisions? Does he know how to fix the economy? Does it, you know, is he going to make the kind of difficult things? You could say lots of things about George.
Did he give me money for a bridge in my constituency?
Well, but I think this is why I think as Chancellor, George Osborne's probably had a really not a bad week necessarily, because I think he's kind of doubled down on some of his, it's one of those things, it's not necessarily positives or negatives, but things that he is known for, which is, you know, he wants to sort out the deficit, he wants to make tough decisions, he feels like he's in control of those things, and he's going to make unpopular things because he thinks they're for the good of the country. And he kind of owns that bit of the Conservative Party brand at the moment, and that's not a terrible place to be either, with the Tory Party, let's face it, are the first bunch of people that are going to be electing him, and secondly, with the country at large. And there's, in some politics, sometimes you need to just double down on the things that you were known for, and there's no harm in that. Secondly, as and when the deficit perhaps isn't being cut as quickly as possible, it's fairly easy for him to turn around, and he has a bogeyman in the House of Lords or whoever it might be who has thwarted his thing. What's interesting is, I think, with the commentariat and some bits of the Conservatives, his kind of it's back to the pasty tax again. It's about his reputation as being a political strategist, which, in fairness, the last election demonstrated, I think, to, you know, be a strength of his. People in the commentariats were referring to them and the Tory party were like, OK, well, he knows how to get stuff done, and so respected that. Whereas it feels a little bit like this week that he made a miscalculation. And so I think it's one of those things where the sort of inside baseball kind of set of people are sort of have a few question marks over that, whereas previously he was seen as quite invincible. After recovering that from the pasty text, which everybody thought was a debacle.
So a chink in the armour almost. I mean, let's talk about Labour a little bit, because obviously the opposition is going to have to respond to this. I mean, in many respects, opposing Tory heartless tax credits isn't a difficult thing to do. But what do we think about sort of Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership's positioning on this, and maybe where they go next, or how they respond in the longer term? I mean, Jeremy Corbyn did seem to do a good job today in Prime Minister's questions in terms of sticking to the one issue and just making, insofar as people even watch it, but sticking to one issue, not letting the Prime Minister wriggle away, and not sort of going off on tangents with lots of different questions. So he seemed quite effective today. But James, I mean, where do you think, how do you think Labour uses this? I mean, in the obvious sense, yes, it's going to make the government a bit unpopular, but at the end of the day, I mean, surely the one thing we've learned about Labour is it's not about pointing out why the Tories are bad, it's about pointing out why you're the party of government.
Well, I think they are going to do, and they're going to do a lot of pointing out why the Tories are bad on this. Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, I think, will focus a lot more than previous leaders have on that in general, and I think specifically in this case, they'll do that a lot. I think what they should be doing is trying to come up with an alternative that saves money, but also protects kind of the hardworking families that politicians across the political spectrum are always trying to appeal to. Maybe that means taking some tough decisions on pensioner entitlements. Maybe that means,
and that is doubling down.
Well, it's a question, isn't it? I mean, at the moment, in order to make hard decisions, you need to really look at where government spends money and how it operates, because there's so many ring fence departments at the moment. There's and the big savings to be made are from the welfare budget. So if you need to if you're attempting to cut the deficit, some savings need to be made in the broader welfare budget. And if you can't do as much as Osborne's trying to do in tax credits, which I think is universally accepted now, then you need to look at other areas. Or maybe it's to not change and not make some of the manifesto commitments the Tories have made, such as bringing down the, moving up the 40p threshold. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't move the tax-free allowance from 10,000 at the moment up to 12,500. Maybe those are policy areas that you could look at.
I mean, Robin, one of the things that would probably help Jeremy Corbyn's leadership out immensely is if Labour was to take a lead in the opinion polls. Do you see that happening, or do you think it even matters given how wrong the polls were at the general election?
I think a lot of the pollsters are still figuring out. I'm not, we've seen a fair amount of volatility in the polls. There was a recent one out today that had the gap down to more or less general election levels of kind of, a 4 or 5 point gap, I think, with Ipsos that had UKIP back up to 12% or something.
I think ICM might have had 4, but then Comrades have got double digit ones because they've got their turnout model.
Well, this is it. It's all very volatile. And of course, if we're talking about an election in 5 years' time, I mean, there's only so much that you can really read into this. Let's remember that.
Also, an election without the current leader of the Tory party as Prime Minister.
Quite.
But the principle, nevertheless, though, is that if Jeremy Corbyn was to take the lead in some polls, that surely takes some wind out of the sails of people within the PLP that would like to oppose.
What's instructive is, this is a complicated issue, which is where we started off with this programme. I think one of the most interesting interventions was Nicola Sturgeon saying, I don't understand why Labour didn't vote to, the kill amendment in the Lords, which, again, without wanting to go into too much detail, but there were four different amendments in the Lords, and the Labour Party supported two of them, but didn't support a third, which would have effectively completely killed the bill dead. And what's interesting is that effectively Labour was saying it was introduced by the Liberal Democrats, and the Liberal Democrat peers voted for it, as did, I believe, the SNP, and certainly the SNP supported it, and Nicola Sturgeon was supporting it. But the reality is it was an impossible motion because you couldn't kill it. So the reality was, all you can do is, send something back to the Commons to revise it. So it's like one of those things which is impossible to explain, but with Labour Party, particularly in Scotland, has ended up with an issue where Nicola Sturgeon's like, don't believe what they're telling you about the Labour Party, stopping, tax credits or reforming it, despite the fact that it was fundamentally the Labour Party amendment that did do that. Nicola Sturgeon turns around and said the Labour Party voted, lots of more Labour peers voted with the Tories to oppose a motion that would have killed this dead. despite the fact that that is in no way a realistic reading of the situation.
And in that YouGov poll, I believe it was people in Scotland were the most likely to think that the changes to tax credits were unfair. So it's something that's going to play to the gallery. And that,
I mean, there's definitely a Scottish element to the whole issue, because welfare is pretty much the one area, area where Westminster still controls controls the whole policy pretty much. I'm not entirely sure how the changes of the Smith Commission, they do impact on it, but not in a meaningful way.
I don't think you're the only one.
But
there you are, yeah.
But it's how a lot of people in Scotland will now view Westminster politics, because health, education, all public services are delivered from Edinburgh. And so this issue, I think Nicola Sturgeon realises that it has the potential it gives Labour an opportunity and has the potential for Labour to be seen as the people who are standing up for working people in Scotland, whereas there's not many opportunities to do that, frankly, from Westminster.
Okay, I guess to close then, you know, let's sort of fast forward to the next general election and where we see House of Lords reform and where we see the sort of the tax credits welfare row going. Briefly, so we can close out. I mean, James, where do you see both of those issues being in 2020?
I think House of Lords reform will be a dead duck, frankly. They won't have made any progress to it. The Strathclyde Commission will prove to be a largely just a talking shop. I think on the tax credits issue, I think George Osborne will have used this as an opportunity to amend it so that his personal reputation isn't damaged too much. And I think he'll probably be about to be crowned Prime Minister of a Tory government.
Rob?
Crowned, eh? I think that's right. I think it would demonstrate ineptness on both the part of the Labour leadership, or George Osborne, for this to be a big issue in the 2020 general election. I think James is right.
The Labour leadership.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it would be easy at the moment. Like, Labour can talk a lot about how they're opposing tax credits. I think they're in a really bad place if they're still talking about opposing tax credits 5 years ago, which have kind of gone through, kind of not made a huge difference because they've been phased in and the minimum wage has risen up like this and the tax-free allowance has gone like this. And, you know, all these kind of changes which will have happened and hopefully with some economic growth in between, that I think it will not be a big issue. And if anything, opposing difficult decisions 4 years ago is probably, I would suggest, not likely to be that prosperous a space for a Labour leadership campaign in 2020.
Yeah, and of course, the bedroom tax whole sort of rallying call didn't seem to do Labour much good at this last election, did it? And as we know, we've got the EU referendum, we've got a new Conservative leader to come, and who knows whether Jeremy Corbyn will be the person to lead Labour into the 2020 election. Many suspect not, but we'll have to wait and see. James and Rob, thanks very much for your time, as ever. That was the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.